and the anger of Achilles turned first against Agamemnon, then against Hector, is at last resolved in a grudging forgiveness when the body of Hector is given back to the Trojans. This, not the fall of Troy, closes the story. So there's a nice succinct half-page summary of the main aspects of the plot, because I'm not going to go through the plot. We're going to see, you know, what is Homer doing in this story. And it's generally, we don't know much about Homer. One thing I do believe, by the way, is that Homer is not Homer's. Because, you know, they're people, and there could be two Homers, in the sense it's possible that the Homer that wrote the Iliad is not the same Homer that wrote the Odyssey. But what is not possible is that the Iliad was written by a committee. Right? I had the dubious pleasure once of, with other members of the faculty at Ivy Mill University, trying to write as a collective a philosophy of the curriculum. And we would spend literally 2 hours arguing over one sentence and the placement of a comma in the sentence and whether the comma should be a semicolon. Right? Committees do not write anything worthwhile. This is a work of individual genius, right? I would say, by the way, Beowulf might have been written by more than one person in theory, but that's because if you actually look at it, it's three different stories, and particularly the third one seems to be tagged on. So that's possible that that was an oral tradition that at some point someone wrote into one script. Anyway, that's for later. All right, so let's go on to page 54 here. Turn your page. We're going to page 54 together. Okay, so this is Richmond Lattimore's attitude to Homer's attitude to the gods. I've said little in this introduction about the part played by the gods in the story of Troy, partly because the modern reader will generally be less interested in human than divine character. Sorry, more interested in human than divine character, partly because the question is too complicated to discuss in brief compass. But I will state briefly a few conclusions. So basically, it's not say much about the gods because we're not really interested in gods, are we, right? And of course, as the gods, that's what gives the Iliad its supernatural character, give it its theological depth. Right? I mean, you said the gods aren't all that interesting to us. You're really saying we're not really interested in any of the deeper supernatural stuff that's going on in the story. So you really, what you're doing in your anti-Christian, anti-supernatural prejudice is stating your inability to actually see the work as Homer saw it. Pride and prejudice. So the gods of Homer are mainly immortal men and women, incomparably more powerful than mortals, but like mortals, susceptible to all human emotions and appetites, therefore capable of being teased, flattered, enraged, seduced, chastised. As immortal people, they may also represent projections of feelings or activities in the observed world. Thus, Ares is an immortal person, son of Zeus, protector of Troy, a brutal and blustering character. Ares is also war, Ares in lowercase, so to speak, and as such, he is a force, a fact, and has no character at all. So in other words, the gods are both persons and personified abstractions. It depends on how they're being used. The two concepts may be combined. When Helen protests to Aphrodite, who has dragged her off to Troy for the sake of an unworthy man, I think she is doing two things at once. First, she is appealing to a supernatural person who is making her do what that person wants. Second, she is talking to herself, so that susceptibility, her own Aphrodite, which has made her behave in a manner which the excellent mind of Helen considers idiotic. Again, the gods as real persons, who also might be projections of our own personalities. Then two, these gods have in relation to men absolute power. God may be overborne by God,